This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
On this week's On the Media, how to tell our real history and make people believe it.
I want to go to that legacy museum because it said something about the lynchings that happened after the abolition of slavery. And I'm like, what?
Most people can't tell you anything about slavery because they don't know that there were 4 million enslaved people living in this country when the Civil War began.
They treat us like animals. I sleep on this naked floor in chains and handcuffs.
There's no point in which we can say, okay, we're done now. This is always going to be what happened.
Look at the feet. Look at the hands. Look at the creases. And I have a much larger vocabulary, but I am still so overwhelmed.
I think a lot of people realize, yeah, something bad really did happen. And they don't want to acknowledge it because they're afraid they're going to be punished for it. I have no interest in punishing this nation for its history. I want to liberate us.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. Bob Garfield is away this week. I'm Brooke Gladstone. This week and next, we're re-airing two episodes about the stories of our histories, the ones we embrace and those we refuse to hear. Because getting history right is pretty much the most important thing citizens can do in a nation at war with itself, as ours was and is. It's often said the North won the war, but the South won the narrative. That's why the battle still rages and still takes casualties every single day. To chronicle the opening of a new front in the war over the Civil War, in May, OTM producer Alana Casanova-Burgess and I went to Montgomery, the first capital of the Confederacy. And not far from our hotel, we saw a sign.
At the start of the Civil War, the city had a larger slave population than Mobile, New Orleans, or Natchez, Mississippi. Slave traders' offices were located primarily along Commerce Street and Market Street, now Dexter Avenue. Yeah.
We're on Commerce right now.
Over time, Montgomery became one of the most important and conspicuous slave trading communities in the United States. After the Alabama legislature banned free black people from residing in the state in 1833, enslavement was the only legally authorized status for African Americans in Montgomery. And that sign was put up by the Equal Justice Initiative, and there it is.
Right next to the Hank Williams Museum.
Right next to the Hank Williams Museum. But look at that, Equal Justice Initiative. It's painted as if it had been there forever, you know? It seems almost to be etched in the brick, as if it had as long a legacy as the slave trade. But it doesn't. This is an effort, I guess, to design it as if it were permanent.
This is a community that prides itself at being the cradle of the Confederacy.
Public interest lawyer Brian Stevenson has sprung well over 100 innocent prisoners from death row, won a historic case ending mandatory life without parole for children under 18, and founded the Equal Justice Initiative in 1989 to help provide legal services to men and women on death row in Alabama. Now EJI is not only defending marginalized people, but marginalized history, a civil rights museum, a lynching memorial attracting headlines across the nation when it opened in the spring. Spotlight on Montgomery.
When we began our work, we bought this building, but we didn't know it was the site of a former warehouse where enslaved people were held. No one had actually documented the primacy of slavery in this community. I went to Berlin you can't really go 100 meters without seeing markers and stones that have been placed next to the homes of Jewish families that were abducted. Germans seemed to want you to go to the Holocaust Memorial. They were intent on changing the narrative. They didn't want to be thought of as Nazis and fascists forever. And I just don't think we've created cultural spaces in this country that motivate people to say never again to this history of enslavement and lynching and segregation. And the absence of that commitment, I think, has left us vulnerable. And not only do we not do that, we actually romanticize this era. And we tell stories about how glorious and wonderful the architects and defenders of slavery are. In Alabama, Confederate Memorial Day is a state holiday. Jefferson Davis's birthday is a state holiday. We do not have Martin Luther King Day in Alabama. We have Martin Luther King / Robert E. Lee Day.
Stevenson has made Montgomery his laboratory in a vast experiment to shift the narrative on American racism's roots and legacy. And he's taken as his models similar efforts in South Africa, Rwanda, Germany, and especially its capital, Berlin, where Stolpersteine, literally stumbling blocks, bear the names of Holocaust victims swept up from nearby apartments, where there's a vast Holocaust memorial just south of the Brandenburg Gate, acres of concrete slabs of various size that you cannot avoid. In Berlin, history comes at you around every corner, but the Nazi viewpoint has no presence there, in the spirit of never again.
The street names are replaced to what they used to be before the Nazis came to power.
Historian Sir Richard Evans is author of The Third Reich in History and Memory. We asked him to trace Germany's path to reckoning.
The concrete swastikas and eagles were taken down. Some smaller buildings were blown up to erase the immediate memory of the Nazi period. And of course, all those millions of people who had Nazi uniforms from the Hitler Youth or the National Socialist Stormtroopers burnt them or buried them or threw them away. The Allies had a huge program of denazification. Old Nazis were fired. There were thousands of trials, not just in Germany, but in Poland and France and other places. And the denazification program involved sending out questionnaires to millions and millions of Germans. It went very far and very deep.
What did you think about the denazification films and newsreels the Allies made?
Yeah, they were made by well-known directors like Billy Wilder or Alfred Hitchcock. Mills of Death was one of them, with archived footage of the concentration camps. Germans were forced to go and see them in local cinemas.
They had been beaten down to live like animals. Far worse, for few animals had lived in the terror, hunger, and filth of these victims.
A lot of Germans simply refused to believe what they'd seen in these films, because they'd been fed a diet of Nazi propaganda lies for 12 years. And most Germans, too, in the immediate aftermath of the war, were simply trying to survive. I mean, there was mass malnutrition, economic conditions were really terrible. So they didn't really want to know. And then it took a long time after that for Germans to accept the idea of democracy. After all, democracy in the 20s in Germany, the Weimar Republic, had led to Nazis coming to power. And it was an economic disaster. First of all, hyperinflation, and then a huge depression, much deeper than the slump in America.
But that was related to the First World War.
Yeah, it was following on that. But I mean, as a result of that, of course, Germans mistrusted democracy. They didn't think it delivered prosperity, whereas Hitler's rearmament had delivered something of a boom. So it wasn't until what the Germans called in West Germany the economic miracle in the 60s, when the German economy recovered, they began to think, well, maybe democracy can actually deliver prosperity.
There was a television series called Holocaust in 1978, starring Meryl Streep. That was really influential.
That's right, it was. It was shown in Germany, and you follow a number of fictionalized characters, a Jewish family, and a young man who joins the SS and becomes, bit by bit, a kind of vicious Nazi thug.
Yes, our job will soon be finished. The Jew free Europe. So perhaps the camps and the machinery could soon be obliterated.
Forgive me, Reichsfuhrer. Would it not be more fitting to let them stand as monuments to our great service to mankind? We have merely followed the logic of European history. A case can be made for Auschwitz.
And that had a big effect in Western Germany. But it's not really till the 1990s that there's a further step towards a reckoning. When the Berlin Wall fell, a lot of West Germans who'd lost their property to the communist regime in East Germany from 1949 onwards, they claimed for the return of their property. There were a couple of million of these lawsuits. And then that sparked former slave laborers of the Nazis from Poland and Eastern Europe to put in their claims. And then there's a whole process of restitution of looted artworks that began in the mid to late 90s.
In Germany today, only the unhinged would reminisce about the virtues of the Third Reich or define its defeat as a lost cause. If there are trunks bearing the moldering remnants of Nazi regalia, they aren't brought out for fun-filled reenactments of the Battle of Belgium. There are no high schools named for Adolf Eichmann, no statues of Heinrich Himmler. Actually, there is one controversial monument in Hamburg. It commemorates a World War I battle, but it was erected by the Nazis and was fascist in its execution. This presented a problem.
That's right. The Hamburg Regiment in World War I, they lost a number of people on the battlefront. And in 1936, in the Nazi period, they put up a big stone block with a concrete relief of the soldiers in their helmets and rifles marching around it. And above it, in Gothic lettering, "Germany must live even if we must die." That isn't necessarily what the soldiers thought at all. And this was thought to be a monument in the terms of National Socialist Nazi ideology. Mm-hmm. So there were a lot of protests. But then, of course, understandably, the relatives and descendants of the men who'd been killed and who were memorialized in this block said, no, you mustn't take it down. You mustn't forget them. So the idea came of constructing an anti-monument next to it. The biggest and most damaging air raid of the entire World War II was in Hamburg in 1943. And 40,000 civilians were killed. And it makes you think, well, you know, that's what happens in a war, then war perhaps isn't as glorious as the monument implies.
To Evans, an ideal solution. If there's a reason to keep a problematic monument, build another one next to it for context, to balance the narrative. Evans argues that the Germans will never return to fascism because they're always coming across, literally stumbling over, these memorials to the victims of the Nazis. But there is a difference between the West and the East. The West was made to feel responsible. The East was not.
Yes, East Germany was controlled by the Soviet Communist Party from 1945 until 1990. And what the East German puppet regime tried to do was to tell East Germans that communists resisted the Nazis and they should identify with the communists. And so they didn't have to confront any sense of involvement in the crimes of Nazism. Mm-hmm. And then on top of that, democratic political culture, which was rooted in West Germany by 1990, had very shallow roots in East Germany. They'd lived under a Soviet dictatorship or a communist dictatorship, and before that under the Nazi dictatorship. So you find that in East Germany, the votes for the anti-immigrant party, the Alternative for Germany, are much, much higher than they are in West Germany. They're still only about a fifth of the electorate. Some of the politicians say that Germans feel too guilty about the Nazi past. It's time to stop feeling guilty. But as I say, most of Germany is a very small minority. Remember, the rise of authoritarian anti-immigrant right-wing leaders who are undermining democracy in all kinds of ways is mostly confined to former communist states. So Poland, Hungary, for example.
Denmark, Sweden.
Czech Republic. No, they're not. They haven't come to power there.
But they're gaining strength.
Yeah, but they're not very strong. I mean, that's the point. So everyone gets terribly worried when the Alternative for Germany scores 15% of the vote. But they forget that virtually every other political party in Germany supports Angela Merkel's policy on letting immigrants into the country. Not just the Christian Democrats, which is her party, but the Social Democrats and the Greens, for example. As I say, it's where democratic values are strongly anchored in political culture that the memory of what happens when you have a far-right dictatorship for most Germans is more than enough to put them off.
So let's recap the lessons of Germany. extirpation of Nazi symbols and ideology, much of it imposed by the Allies bearing gifts, prosperity, generational shift, and yes, responsibility finally internalized in the form of reparations. In America, still marked by slavery's legacy, that seems like a very uphill climb. Brian Stevenson's EJI started with signs, and even those met with resistance. Now he has a museum and a memorial, testaments to an ugly past that we can no longer afford to ignore, and a challenge to the nation designed to shame communities that turn away. All that's coming up in the next segment. But first, we presented a challenge to our listeners to look at your streets, your monuments, to see who was being memorialized and to let us know.
My name is Loretta Cooper, and I live in Fairfax County, Virginia. The neighborhood that I would like to bring to your attention, it is called Mosby Woods, and it's named after John Singleton Mosby, who was a Confederate Army battalion commander in the Civil War. And the streets in this neighborhood are named things like Plantation Parkway, Confederate Lane, Scarlet Circle, Shiloh Street, Ranger Road, Raider Lane. It goes on and on. But what makes all this even worse, in my estimation, is that these aren't houses that were built in the early 20th century. These houses were actually built in the mid-1960s, well after the Civil Rights Movement had had an opportunity to seep into the consciousness of Americans. And always seemed to me the real intentional insult and poke in the eye to the better angels of our nature. Thanks for this. Bye.
This is On the Media.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC.
This week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, I'll talk with psychologist Jonathan Haidt about his book, The Anxious Generation.
We're overprotecting in one place, and I'm saying, lighten up, let your kids out. And we're underprotecting in another, and I'm saying, don't let your kids spend 9 hours a day on the internet talking with strange men. It's just not a good idea.
Jonathan Haidt on the New Yorker Radio Hour from WNYC Studios. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. Montgomery marks its history, and though most of the signage in granite is devoted to the Confederacy, more recent events increasingly intrude. Take the intersection of Dexter Court and Commerce. There's a telegraph office where, in 1861, General P.G.T. Beauregard was authorized to attack Fort Sumter and launch the Civil War. Across from that is the bus stop where Rosa Parks boarded her bus and took the fateful seat she refused to surrender in 1955. At the intersection's heart is the artesian basin fountain, site of a slave market, marked with a sign. Slaves of all ages were auctioned, along with land and livestock, standing in line to be inspected. Public posters advertised sales and included gender, approximate age, first name, slaves didn't have last names, skill, price, complexion, and owner's name. In the 1850s, able field hands brought $1,500. Skilled artisans, $3,000.
That's Lee Street over there.
Of course, our ultimate destination is the Equal Justice Initiative's Legacy Museum, from enslavement to mass incarceration. On the way, we meet another museum goer.
Yeah. Where are you from?
Right now, I'm from Georgia.
My husband is Air Force, and he's teaching at the Air Force base right now.
Great.
So I'm just tooling around. I was going to this Rosa Parks Museum this morning, walked around the corner, and the security guard there, you know, I was just looking at the building, and she said, did you see the poem on the side of the building?
What is the poem?
History, despite its wrenching pain, cannot be unlived, but if faced with courage, not need be lived again. Maya Angelou? So then she took my picture in front of the Legacy Museum. That's the one you're talking about?
That's the one.
I want to go to that. I got to do that at least. Because it said something about, the injustice and the lynchings that happened after the abolition of slavery.
Oh,
and I'm like,
yeah.
What? Up until 1950. I'm a skeptical person that feels I can't believe everything that I read, see, hear. But, you know, you can hear it at least. I mean, you can take in the history lessons, you know, and that's where each person has to weigh the evidence that they see. And it's not like I'm looking to be persuaded or not be persuaded. Injustice happened, for sure. That's why I took a picture of that poem. For sure, we don't need to relive it.
I was surprised by her skepticism about the persistence of lynching, since photographs are easily found and the one of Emmett Till's body in 1955 is historic, having galvanized the civil rights movement. But Brian Stevenson wasn't surprised.
That's not an uncommon perspective. Most people can't tell you anything about slavery because they don't know that there were 4 million enslaved people living in this country when the Civil War began. They certainly don't understand that the great evil of American slavery wasn't involuntary servitude and forced labor. It was this ideology of white supremacy, this narrative of racial difference. And for me, that's the narrative that we haven't actually come to grips with, this notion that black people aren't fully human. That was the true toxin that poisoned our nation.
He wants the Legacy Museum to connect the dots, to show how the evolution of the slave market made slaves even more vulnerable and emboldened the owner who depended on them to treat them less and less as human beings, and to convey the humanity of the slave, the anguish you'd think anyone could imagine. But why would we, really?
We banned the international slave trade in 1808, which was actually before Alabama was a state, before Mississippi was a state, before Louisiana was a state, before the Deep South had actually formed. 1 million enslaved people were moved from the North to the South, where enslaved people were losing their value with increasing calls for abolition. Slave owners didn't want to be caught owning property that they could not get a return on, and so they wanted to trade that to a region where there were people still willing to buy. And that created the domestic slave trading that became so especially brutal. That's what separated children from mothers and families were broken up, etc. And it was harder labor.
Once in the museum, Alana and I were struck immediately by holographic images of people in cells, slaves, glowing with their own light and speaking of loss.
Can you see my children? It seems like I hear my daughter calling out for me, but I can't find her.
And we want them to have a first-person narrative.
She fell at his feet, clung to his knees, entreating him to buy a baby as well as herself.
We employ this technology that shows you the slave pens where people are held. And then the ghosts of these enslaved people emerge, and we use actual slave narratives that people recite.
I sleep on this naked floor in chains and handcuffs. When they take us out on the block, they want us to sell ourselves. Don't be selling. Praise yourself or you're sure to be beaten.
You know, we've heard spirituals, and you can go to the most ornate concert halls. These songs have become part of the canon, but it's only when you hear a spiritual being sung by an enslaved person in chains in a slave pen, it's only when you hear someone singing in that setting that you begin to understand the grief and anguish that produced this music. And then we want them to see the slave catalogs, which we blow up on banners, to see books that are titled Negroes, Mules, Carts, Wagons, to see the descriptions of people, children, their crisis. And then to hear the expressions of grief from enslaved people, for me, that was really critical. One woman says, selling is worse than flogging. She said, my back has been beaten many times, but has always healed. They sold my husband away. My heart is not right yet. Until you have a perspective on what it means to be ripped from the only thing you get as an enslaved person, which is the opportunity to love someone, your child, your spouse, your parent, then you're not going to appreciate the devastation. And then when you see that instead of remedying 250 years of enslavement, we actually aggravated by terrorizing people through lynching. And we try to make that tangible. When you go into our museum, you see jars of soil. The community groups had gone to lynching sites and collected soil and put it in jars with the names and places of these lynchings. Because we've made that history invisible, we want to make it tangible.
It's Robert Lewis in Port Jervis, New York, June 2nd, 1892. Mary Jackson, Harrison County, Texas, February 13th, 1912. Got Georgia, Colorado, Kentucky.
Had gathered to watch as John Hartfield was hung from a tree. As he swung, his fingers were amputated and passed around as souvenirs while he screamed in pain. The crowd then shot over 2,000 bullets into his body until a final bullet severed the rope, dropping his body to the ground where he was burned on the spot. Postcards of the proceedings were sold for 20 cents to those wishing to commemorate the day.
I have argued that slavery didn't end in 1865, it just evolved. It turned into decades of terrorism and violence where black people were pulled out of their homes, they were drowned, they were hanged, they were beaten, and everybody was complicit. The courts, law enforcement, elected officials, churches, teachers, schools would all come out and celebrate these acts of torture. And it was so traumatizing that 6 million black people fled the American South. It was one of the largest mass migrations in world history, and we haven't talked about that. Because I don't think that the black people in Cleveland and Chicago and Detroit and LA and Oakland went there as immigrants looking for opportunities. They went there as refugees and exiles from terror. And the generational poverty we see in those communities, the consequences of being displaced from land and the opportunity to develop wealth is still evident. And rather than acknowledge this role of terror and lynching and creating this reality, we blame these communities. I mean, you had, at the end of the 19th century, hundreds of thousands of formerly enslaved black people who had skills and trades and had the ability to create wealth through agriculture, through industry, but they weren't allowed to do that because their lives were menaced whenever they became too successful. And so this wealth gap that we talk about in America can't be understood until you understand the way in which we use terror and violence to prevent wealth accumulation in the African-American community, and then displacement aggravated that. And then we blocked black veterans and others from entering the middle class through redlining and denying them loans and economic opportunities. And I think the galling part for many people is that they hear folks now saying that we're dealing with domestic terrorism for the first time in our nation's history after 9/11. And for older people of color, that's an insult. It's an added injury because they grew up with terror. And that's why these narratives of lynching become so important. People weren't lynched just because they were accused of some violent crime. They were lynched because they were successful in business. They were lynched because they insisted on being treated fairly. When they asked for better wages as sharecroppers, they would be lynched. When they asked for better conditions as coal miners, they would be lynched. When a black man got too close to a white woman, he would be lynched. When a black woman complained about her husband being lynched as being unjust, she would be lynched. And this violence was intended to sustain racial hierarchy. And our complete absence of awareness contributes to this false narrative, this false understanding of who we are. Changing that, for me, is key. If we understood that we did horrific things to enslave black people, we tortured them, we raped them, we had children taken from their parents, and we promised freedom after emancipation, and what we gave instead was terrorism.
It's a short walk from the museum to EJI's National Memorial for Peace and Justice, the Lynching Memorial. Every lynching, when it is known, every county, every date, every name, is engraved on copper columns, suspended from poles, higher and higher as you proceed through the site. So many.
This is very much like the memorial in Berlin. I mean, it's different because it looks like in Berlin a bunch of tombstones, tall and short and tall, on a hill and down, that seem to represent men, women, and children. And here, they're suspended on poles. And so it definitely gives you the impression of hanging.
Tatnall County,
Georgia.
And the first date is 1894. And then the next four all have the same last name, Paget. Dosia, Sam, Sula, and Wilford. And they all were lynched on the same day, May 21st, 1907. And I think that tells you as much a story as anything here. And that these people were killed as a group. This family was exterminated.
Henry Smith, 17, lynched in Paris, Texas.
Oh, there's Kettle Parish.
Oh, my God. Is that where you're from?
That's where I was born. And,
I see a white on there, Bob.
You see a white on there?
Bill White.
Yeah. And this is the first one I've seen Kettle Parish.
In 1886.
From this angle, right, when we have to stretch our necks up, it puts you under their bodies in the same way that a mob would be.
I wonder if you want to create a sense of complicity.
Yeah, I don't think there's any question. I mean, when you go to Brandenburg Gate and you see the Holocaust Memorial, you are trusted to bring into that space an understanding of the Holocaust that will allow you to have a meaningful interaction with those wordless structures. In America, we could not create a memorial with no words, because people don't have an understanding of this history. And so when you walk into our memorial, you walk down a path where we narrate this past. And we have to remind people about the enslavement that precedes. And that's why we have that slavery sculpture by Kwame Okoto Bamfo. And for many people, it's the first time they've ever seen a sculpture with human beings about slavery. That's how silent we have been.
It depicts human suffering in exquisite detail, as one viewer observed.
Look at the feet. Look at the hands. Look at the creases. And I have a much larger vocabulary, but I am still so overwhelmed. I can't say anything else.
The figures are in chains. You see a mother holding a baby.
And then you see an empty pair of shackles lying on the ground, and their story is told.
That reflects the 2 million kidnapped people who died during that a slave trade, but what he also presents with these figures that are streaked, the copper streaks down them, you see their anguish and pain, but you also see their humanity, their dignity. The name of that installation is called Unchinchim, which is from an African proverb that talks about resilience and resistance to oppression. And then you walk into the monuments. Our country has been largely silent, and so it hangs over us. It is a cloud, it's a shadow that continues to haunt us. And as those columns begin to rise, they are lifted up. One, because that's what racial terror lynchings were about. They wanted to lift up these bodies because they wanted to torment communities of color. And that terror can't be understood without replicating those dynamics. And so we lift them up because, unlike the nation state of Germany, we have not been willing to talk about this history. We are a small private organization creating a space for this story to be told. And until that story is acknowledged and other institutions and people reckon with this history, it will continue to haunt us. And we give people the opportunity. We have a replica for each one of those monuments in the park. And we are asking people in communities to have these conversations and to claim their monument.
How many counties across the nation?
There are about 840.
How many states?
About 29 states.
What you're asking is for counties to own their histories, basically put this replica of what you have in the museum
in the location where the lynching took place.
Right. I do think there is something about sites of conscience, about places where horrific things happen. There's a reason why people go to Anne Frank's house. There's a reason why we have a 9/11 memorial. Less than 15 years after 9/11, we wanted to create something to make future generations understand the agony of that moment. We do believe in memorials. We just haven't been willing to memorialize the most tragic and devastating aspects of our history that relate to lynching and slavery and segregation. And so, yes, I think the monuments create an opportunity for communities to begin a process of recovery, of reconciliation, of restoration. But they will be there. And if the communities don't engage, the monument becomes a sort of report card, which communities have claimed their history and which ones haven't.
That whole section where the replicas lay, you hope one day will be empty.
That's the hope, and that there'll be information about every county in this country that did something in response to that sense of dread and menace that people experience when they walk through the memorial.
The memorial is the experience I'll take home with me, the one I'll never forget. It felt elemental and real. The columns had names and places, and they forced me to look up and up and up. The replicas, the twin columns, which all those counties are called upon to claim, along with their dark history and acknowledgement of the annihilated, including in my state of New York, I hope they are claimed. They must be claimed.
Hi, I live here in Austin, Texas, and recently people decided to change the name of some streets that might have been named after Robert E. Lee. And I think it's very funny because if there's a move to get rid of Confederate names here in Austin and in Texas, then they're going to need to get rid of all the Texas history names, including Austin, named after Stephen F. Austin, who is a slaveholder, Travis County, named after William Travis, who's a slave owner, and Houston, of course, also named after Sam Houston, who is a slave owner. So that's what's funny.
This is On the Media. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone, reporting from Montgomery, Alabama. It's often been noted with hope that the arc of history is long, but it bends towards justice. I wondered how attorney Brian Stevenson, who's pursued justice his whole life, found his arc bending towards history. I asked him to trace it.
I grew up in a community where black children had to go to the colored schools. This was in southern Delaware on the eastern shore. There were no high schools for black kids when my dad was a teenager. He couldn't go to high school in our county. And I remembered when lawyers came into the community and made them open up the public schools. And it was so powerful because I don't think you could persuade the majority of people in that community to integrate on their own. It took the rule of law. And that planted a seed in my head that maybe the law could protect disfavored people in ways that the political process couldn't.
So let me ask you this. You've described redressing injustice. Then you undertook to redress history. Can you tell me how you got from there to here?
While I was really proud of a lot that we had achieved, it became clearer to me that there were constraints. I'm a product of Brown versus Board of Education, but in 1987, when we challenged racial bias in the death penalty, what the court held was that these disparities based on race are inevitable. It's almost as if they gave up on this commitment to equal justice under law.
Was there a particular decision, a particular moment, when you just said, well, I can keep bashing my head against the wall and see the horizon retreat in front of me, or I can take on this audacious task of American history?
I think it did begin with that case, McCleskey versus Kemp in 1987, when the Supreme Court upheld the death penalty despite overwhelming evidence that race of the victim was the greatest predictor of who got the death penalty. In case after case, we were challenging the exclusion of African Americans from juries. The court just continued to shrug its shoulders, and it was a sort of a gradual awareness that we were going to have to change the environment outside the courts. And that's when we decided that we were going to have to talk more honestly about the history of racial inequality that I think has made us indifferent. I went to Johannesburg and spent time in the Apartheid Museum, was very moved by a cultural institution that was intent on making sure people do not forget apartheid. I researched the Genocide Museum in Rwanda, and you can't go to Rwanda without being forced to hear about what happened. I go to the Holocaust Museum here in the United States, and when I get to the end of it, I am motivated to say, along with many others, never again.
What is the false narrative?
That to the extent that slavery was a problem, it was a problem because people were forced to labor against their will. But people were well treated. People weren't that unhappy to be enslaved. Slave owners were generous and kind.
Is that what people think in Alabama?
It's what people think all over America. Michelle Obama gave a speech at the Democratic National Convention where she talked about living in a house built by slaves, and she was attacked.
Today, I wake up every morning in a house that was built by slaves. And I watch my daughters, two beautiful, intelligent black young women, playing with their dogs on the White House lawn.
Slaves that worked there were well fed and had decent lodgings provided by the government, which...
It is preposterous to believe that you are so off on slavery. Like in the Holocaust, you can only speak about it in unequivocal damnation.
They can't stop talking about slavery. And largely in a context of, hey, you know what? It isn't settled yet. Hey, we haven't fixed it yet. And I think that's a no-win situation.
I hear people talking about the civil rights movement, and it's starting to sound like a three-day carnival. On day one, Rosa Parks didn't give up her seat on a bus. On day two, Dr. King led a march on Washington. And on day three, we passed these laws and racism was over. And I wish that were our history, but there was tremendous resistance to civil rights. Our elected officials said segregation forever, and they've never repudiated that narrative. We created an educational system that now is every bit as segregated as it was in the 1960s. And so we haven't done a very good job of confronting that. And I knew we were in trouble when I saw state tourism agencies taking out ads and civil rights memorial books saying things like, in 1963, Dr. Martin Luther King partnered with the people of Alabama to create a better future. Literally the language that is used. If you think polio is just like a cold, then you're not committed to creating a polio vaccination. Most Americans would say that if they were alive during the 19th century, they would, of course, be trying to end slavery. Would say that if they were alive in the 1920s and 30s, they would do whatever they can to stop lynching. Everybody would claim to be on the side of the civil rights marchers and wanting to end segregation. And I don't think you can claim to have been an abolitionist or an anti-lynching crusader or a civil rights protester if you're living in a society where evidence of horrific racial bias characterizes our criminal justice system and you say nothing, you do nothing. And that legacy is part of what we want people to confront. We want them to wrestle with the fact that the state of Alabama still prohibits black and white kids from going to school together in our state constitution, and we can't get it out because a majority of people keep voting to keep it in. We want them to wrestle with the fact that we throw children away, that we don't seem to respond to constraints on voting rights for African Americans. And then we want to pose the question, are we willing to say never again? Are we sufficiently moved by an understanding of this history that we're now prepared to make that commitment? Because if we make that commitment, a lot of things will have to change. We're not going to be able to accept the kind of police shootings of unarmed black people that we've accepted. We're not going to be able to tolerate restrictions on voting rights in communities of color. We're not going to be able to ignore these disparities in suspension and expulsion rates in schools. We're going to have to think differently about confronting the legacy of this history.
So what happens when a nation does commit itself to the task of confronting its history? Brian returns again and again to the German experience. But what's the impact on Germans who have no personal memory of the Nazis or even of the Berlin Wall? Peter Weissenberger is 30 years old, an editor for the Society and Media section with Taz newspaper in Berlin. He seemed to be someone I could ask. Do you think
that exposure to these monuments growing up changed you?
I mean, as I grew up in the countryside, I didn't see a lot of monuments. What I saw was television productions, movies about what happened, documentaries. They're also monuments, right? Did it change me? Definitely. I mean, it was ever present. For me, being German is mostly about that. Right-wing people tend to say that there's this, like, originality to what Germans are. That's not true. Most of what defines being German is to deal with that kind of history and not to forget.
There are a lot of people who say that until we deal with slavery and its legacy, which may be our defining feature, we'll never progress.
Possibly. The controversial thing is about it that once you start, you're never going to be done. So there's no such thing as dealing with it and then finally having dealt with it. And I think this is what makes people so afraid to start dealing with history at all. There's no point in which we can say, okay, we're done now. This is always going to be what happened. There's always going to have been millions of people that were killed in a fascist, racist killing machinery and a whole society of bystanders. And it's much easier to sort of compartmentalize it and be outraged as somebody puts a large monument right in the middle of your capital. I mean, right-wing people now are addressing it as a wound of shame that's in the middle of our capital.
The Holocaust Memorial.
The Holocaust Memorial. Because they want history, especially the history of Germany, to be something where there's this thing that happened, but that's in the past. We strayed off our path there. But I believe that it's more important to acknowledge that this part of your history makes up the organism of your society and something that is always going to be tearing on you. And this is what a lot of people feel like can't be asked of them, to always feel like there's something internally wrong with the way that their society was created.
And what do you think?
I mean, what are you going to do? This is our starting point. This is the starting point of the way that our constitution is written. It wouldn't have been written that way if it wasn't for fascism. The way that our media work, the way that our parliamentary system works, and it's the way that now a lot of people are looking at immigration and at racism and refugees, positioning themselves when it comes to those issues, has to do with the past. And how are you going to compartmentalize that? How are you going to say this has nothing to do with what we are now?
In terms of slavery, certainly the founding documents were made in such a way so that slavery could continue in order to create a unified nation or a nation that could live with itself. Of course, it just put off the problem for 80 years.
I mean, to be fair, Germany had the allies who came there and who decided what the narrative was going to be. The kind of consensus, quote unquote, that we have now, that this is a horrible thing that happened and this is the way we have to deal with it, that did not emerge organically. There were outside forces. I'm not saying that you can't have that, but I don't think we have the illusion that this is something that can come out of society without any conflict. There's going to be people that are emotionally invested in the narrative that they have now.
That the Civil War was fought over states' rights.
Yeah, and that some ancestor died in the Civil War for what he thought was right, and you don't want anybody to come and tell you that he died for the wrong idea. That's a pretty harsh thing to wrap your head around to. I'm not saying that you can't and you shouldn't. There's other parts of the society that are saying, but yeah, we have to deal with it. You can't just like make excuses because there's like some great-great-grandfather who died there. This is our right to have that kind of injustice addressed. There's going to be a lot of fighting around this.
And so it has been. Do you ever resolve it? Absent in an outside power?
Probably easiest to do away with the idea of resolution. In the case of the United States, at least, to deal with it constantly and to try and make progress and institute mechanisms that make it possible for future generations to engage with the issue in a new way, but not to believe that everybody can come to the conclusion that we now have a consensus on what happened and how we have to go from here.
Well, thanks, Peter.
You're very welcome.
You've said many times that no person is the worst thing that they've ever done. And yet it seems that we as a country cannot get past the worst thing that we have ever done.
I don't think our nation believes that the genocide of Native people is the worst thing we've ever done, or slavery is the worst thing we've ever done, or lynching is the worst thing we've ever done, or even segregation. I think we've actually created a narrative that those things weren't that bad. And not only do we not need to recover from that, we don't even need to be remorseful about that. There is no shame.
But it is the worst thing we've ever done.
It is, in fact. And I want the nation to have the courage to own up to that, with the knowledge that if they own up to that, they won't be condemned by it, that there is something on the other side of it, which is why we do this work. I represent a lot of people who've done terrible things. And it's in that context that I've come to understand that we are all more than the worst thing we've ever done. We are more than a country that perpetrated a genocide. We're more than a slave society. We're more than a lynching society. We're more than a segregation society. But we cannot ignore that bad thing we did. And there is redemption waiting. There is recovery waiting. There is reconciliation waiting. There's something that feels more like justice than what we have experienced in America. There is something better waiting for us without this burden, this history of racial inequality holding us down. But we can't get there through silence, by pretending that the history doesn't exist. We've got to own up to it.
My name is Marshall, as in Marshall County in Northeast Alabama, where I grew up. Our county was incorporated in 1838 and named for Chief Justice John Marshall, who defied President Andrew Jackson and tried to defend the Cherokee people's legal right to stay in their homeland. That a county was named for a defender of a people whose removal made said county legally possible has always struck me as upside down, counterintuitive. The naming of the neighboring county, Jackson, seems far more appropriate. The only explanation I can conjure is that someone in that council had a rock solid conviction as to the injustice of it all and determined to leave a signpost for future generations to contemplate. And oh, how I would like to have been a fly on the wall during that naming.
On the Media was produced this week by Alana Casanova-Burgess and edited by executive producer Katya Rogers. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson, and our engineer this week was Greg Rippon. We thank all the listeners who sent in their observations of how their communities memorialize the past. On the Media is produced by WNYC Studios. Bob Garfield will be back next week. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
On the Media is supported by the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.